I will suggest that every one of us stand up in this room, stretch our legs, and then we sit down to continue in the respect of getting maximum momentum and time for the benefit of everyone.
Thank you. I think that's a great idea.
Yes. And it gives Nancy a chance to close the session and reopen it. So over to the voice of God.
We are now going to go into the expert working group final report discussion session. Thank you.
So I noticed that people are taking a, what do the Americans call it, a comfort break. So we're going to, we will start in 2 minutes, 2 minutes time. Okay, guys, if you could take your seats, please. We'll start. So, everybody, please take your seats. We're starting again. Okay, one more call before we start. Please take your seats. Take them out of the room, Wendy. So thank you all very much for A, being speedy, and B, being prepared to sit through the slide presentation. Now, the purpose of this session really is for you to ask your questions. As Jean-François said, if we would appreciate it if we could, at this session, we could stick to questions on the report, on the presentation, and so on. I know that some of you may have some process questions, but as he's pointed out, we're still working with Stephanie on her dissent piece, and so we can run those, if we can roll those through to Wednesday morning, that would be fine. I thought I would start just very briefly giving you the board's perspective, just so that you know, because Michele said, you know, stay calm, read the report. I would say that the same thing. Some of you would have been with the board and the GNSO yesterday when we talked about next steps. And really, at this stage, the key is we're not in a rush. We're not suggesting that this report simply becomes implemented. We're not talking about bypassing the GNSO. We're simply we've produced this expert's report, and we acknowledge that it's long and complicated, and we want feedback on it. So to be clear, there will be a series of webinars, Q&As, etc., over the next period of time. I know that I don't actually know what timing we're intending, but I would like to put a stake in the ground to say that actually we probably need to leave a reasonable period of time before we start those. People will need to come down from the joys of being in London. Those of you who live in the Northern Hemisphere and are European disappear for the whole of August for some bizarre reason. So I think we need to be sure that we allow a little bit of time for the report to be absorbed, and certainly I think the board would appreciate that as well. So we are going to have those. We have asked the GNSO to do some work for us. The main thing that I asked them to do yesterday was to give us a list of the things that they would like us to do before we give them a policy development process. So to take a simple example, there are some things in the report that will require a deeper legal analysis than has currently been done, and effectively will require legal advice. And I know that members of the GNSO would probably prefer that we did that first, and so that they got the report with the required information, rather than having to have them do it during a PDP. So we've asked the council to consider the sorts of stuff they think we should do to assist with the report when it goes into them for the PDP. We have never done this before. So we don't know really what process the process will be, but I want everybody to be really clear that the board wants to work with the GNSO community to come up with a process to run this through that is workable.
Okay.
Now, let's have a discussion. So there's a microphone, as usual, and I'm waiting for someone, Steve, thank you, to come to the microphone. Steve, over to you.
Thank you. Steve Metalitz. First, I want to thank the expert working group. As someone who has been a 15-year veteran of the debates within ICANN about who is, I think you guys have changed the terms of debate. You've delivered a game changer here. From now on, I think the discussion will be framed in this by some of these general issues, not to say where it's going to end up, but it's certainly the next phase here is going to be defined by what all of you have done. It's a very impressive piece of work, and as I said, I think it's a game changer in a debate that has become very unproductive. We're going to be looking at this. I should say I'm speaking here on behalf of the Coalition for Online Accountability, which represents the copyright interests that depend upon access to this registrant data for many purposes, including enforcement of their intellectual property rights. We're going to be looking at this very carefully and reading the bloody report, as Michele asked us to do. Obviously, there are a lot of trade-offs here that we're going to have to kind of weigh pros and cons from our perspective. But I'd like to ask about two other perspectives that I think are going to be very critical to the overall fate or reception of this proposal. One of them is from the data protection authorities. One of the downsides of the current system is that many or some data protection authorities think it's illegal in some countries. I'd say having observed this for 15 years, their bark is much worse than their bite on this issue. In fact, there has been no bite, and that in itself is kind of a dog that didn't bark moment. It's very significant to me, but it's definitely an issue. And therefore, one thing that will, I think, influence the overall outcome here is whether data protection authorities who have been complaining about the current system think that this system or something along these lines will satisfy their concerns. That's a huge issue from our perspective, because if they do, that obviously is a big plus on the side of these trade-offs. The second one I'd like to mention, and I don't know how this came, whether it came up in your deliberations, but in the first media coverage that I saw about this, the first one that actually kind of got it about what you guys were up to, the issue was raised about how this will affect the press and the media. And right now, every day I see press stories that use Whois data. Anytime anything weird or funny or sinister happens on the net, very often there's one of the factoids is there, who has registered the domain name that's associated with that behavior that's been newsworthy for some reason. I think it's clear from the slide about what's available to the public that journalists will no longer get that information to be able to see those stories unless they fall into one of the other purposes. So there's obviously a freedom of expression, freedom of the press issue here, and I would just ask whether that came up in your deliberations and how you think that ought to be vetted in order to find out what journalists, the media, think about this aspect of the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Who wants to? McKaylee?
I do enjoy going head-to-head with Steve, so I thought I'd try this one. McKaylee Lynn, for the record. On the data privacy thing, I'm very, very conscious of the issues around the current Who Is. Most of you know that I've been embroiled in quite lively debate with ICANN on this matter. Article 29 and others have written to ICANN on several different occasions expressing general discontentment with the current status. Now, whether or not what we're proposing will make them very, very, very happy or not, I honestly don't know because I'm not them. But what we have come up with, I would think, goes a very, very long way because we're removing the concept of making all the data available to everybody all the time, which was the main issue that they had. If you look at the way, for example, the .eu Who Is operates, if you do a port 43 Who Is lookup, you just get back the domain name, available, unavailable, the name servers, and the registrar. If you want to get more data, you need to go to a web-based system, which may be protected by some form of CAPTCHA, and if you're a private individual, the amount of data is completely minimized. And that has to be done in concordance with EU law because the .eu registry operates under contract to the EU Commission. So I would say that what we're proposing should appease them. I'm not the expert. I would defer to Stephanie, obviously.
Do you want to say something? No? Okay. I think your question about the media is a very interesting one as well. I mean, presumably we could create a fourth estate purpose if we wanted to, but the question is, what would the purpose be? You know, to make fun of somebody because they've got an interesting website or something. But I take your point. I think it's a very valid point. Carlton, go ahead.
Thank you, Chris. I was responding to the media question. We do recognize research purposes, and the media might be able to access in researching a story or so in that way. As long as the purpose is permissible, then they can get. And recall that we said that we do not believe we covered every single purpose. So there could be other purposes established, and as long as they're established, they're permissible. Thanks.
I agree with, although as the DNS research was described here, it wouldn't cover, like,
no,
daily press. But
that's a fair point, absolutely. Sir?
Hi, my name is Alex Deacon with the MPAA, and I'd like to also thank you very much for your work. It's an amazing report, and appreciate very much the hard work that everyone put in. I have a more softball question to kick things off. I have many technical questions, but we can put those off till later on. But on the slide before this, the question was asked, the fundamental question is, does this meet the needs, and if not, can the current Who Is system continue to meet whatever needs? I forget how it was phrased exactly. So who's going to answer those questions, or how will that question be answered? Because it seems to be that until we answer that question, we really can't move too far forward.
It's a matter for the ICANN community, but if anybody else wants to say something else.
So it's us as multi-stakeholders.
Correct.
It's not the board. It's not the GNSO. It's
no. It's the community.
It's us.
Yes. It's you will. Be, if this proceeds, it'll be your fault. Jimson.
Thank you, Jimson Olufuye. I would like to really congratulate the ESPA Working Group for the great job you've been doing. I had the privilege of to have followed the outputs you generated over time. Well, I just want to ask this question concerning audit. You know, audit provides assurance for the system. So I want to find out what measure of audit is, do you have inbuilt into the system, or is it external? Thank you.
Audits. Who's in charge of audits?
Rod.
Yeah, I think that was actually my subgroup that looked at this. Jimson, if you look into the document, you'll find a whole section of principles on audit and escrow. Right? We think that it's an absolute requirement that you know, that there be records kept of the transactions that are being performed, who is asking, for example, so that people will have a right to be able to find out who is asking about their data. All right, so much more detail in the report.
James.
Hi, thanks. James Little speaking, just on my own, on behalf. Question, going two speakers ago, I think, you know, question regarding next steps and the path forward from here. I think that there's some discussion within the council, at least informally at this point, on what the next steps are. It seems like there's some work, there's a body of work need to be done to take from the output of this work to the input of a PDP. My question to the EWG is, what would you like to see as part of a recipe for next steps, and where would that occur? And I would submit that that starts with the GNSO Council.
Were you here when I started? Because I talked about the legal stuff which you brought up in the GNSO yesterday.
No, I think Avery brought up some too.
No, getting legal advice before we started.
I came in.
Okay.
So, okay. Cool. So I guess, but I'm asking the panel.
Sure.
I mean, what sort of things would they see as critical milestones that have to be hit between the here and there? And then a second question, and I do mean this, you know, in a spirit of collaboration and not to be like up here throwing stones, but you know, we have this group now. We have concluded your work after an extensive period of time with these recommendations. I know Susan, Kathy, others, we were on the AOC authorized or mandated WHO is review team as well. How do you see your work interleaving with the work that came out of the WHO is review team? We heard that referenced by Steve Crocker this morning, that work would continue the implementation of those recommendations. Do you see any friction there?
I'm happy for anyone to answer it. I've got something to say, but you go ahead.
She wasn't the party.
So on your second question about, yeah, you know, how I think our experience and our report on the from the WHO is review team definitely sparked this team to be created and informed a lot of our decisions. And, you know, we used it as guidance. Where were the sticking points that we had trouble with? Where did we have to stop because our mandate was this? We agreed upon as a team certain parameters to discuss, and we didn't have that here, so we could discuss everything. And so I think, at least for me personally, the experience of the WHO's review team really helped me participate in this team and maybe move the ball forward in our thinking on certain issues.
So I don't want to diminish the value of that. I think, have a more just fundamental question of the recommendations that came out of the WHO is review team. Are there any of them that are now have been obsoleted by your work?
No.
Are there some that support your work specifically? I guess I'm looking for
you want more detail.
What, you know, not necessarily a scorecard between the two, but I'm looking
James,
to understand.
Let Margie or Denise,
yeah,
respond.
Thanks.
Or it'd be easier.
And I'll go ahead and sit down.
That's right. And I'm going to respond to your other part of your question in a minute.
This is Margie Milam with ICANN staff. We've looked at this from a parallel approach. So we continue on the improvements on WHO is until something happens on this side. And this may be a many-year process. And so currently we're working on some of the implementations. We had a session on it yesterday with the GAC, and I'm happy to provide a link to that. I'll provide a link in the chat. But yes, we're not doing anything at this juncture to set aside the improvements to the current WHO is system.
Yeah, let me sort of take us back to the beginning of this. So the board approved the board approved the Who Is Rex, and they are proceeding down the track that they proceed down, and you may not think they're being done fast enough or at all or whatever, but they are on their track. What then happened was that we got a report from the ICANN Security and Stability Advisory Committee, which talked about, in very, very blunt terms, about the need to go back to the bottom line, to stage one, and start again. And that's what this working group was tasked with doing. So the two things are entirely separate. This is a clean slate approach, which obviously needs to go through a whole series of iterations within the GNSO before anything else occurs. And then even when that happens, there's going to have to be an implementation stage, and that may well take some time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it is certainly not the intention that in the meantime, Who is not continued to be improved or whatever needs to happen. That's the first point. Second point is that one of the reasons why the board decided that having this independent experts working group was a good way to start was because everybody acknowledged, including all of the GNSO, that if we started a policy development process in the GNSO on Who Is, it wasn't going to work. So the idea was to have this clean slate start to provide the GNSO with a series of boundaries within which to prepare to create its policy development. So the goal has always been to provide, I don't want to use the term gates because it has a different meaning, boundaries within which you guys will work. Now, the reality is we have never done this before. So now is the time for, once you've all established, read the report, et cetera, we need to work together to figure out what the next steps are. Because you might say, well, do some stuff first. You might say, you know, let's use this methodology or whatever. So that's not only where you've disappeared to, James, but that's basically the goal. Sir.
Hi, my name is Paul Keating. I'm a lawyer in this space. I represent a lot of third-party service providers who depend on Who Is data and related data concerning domain names to serve up this data in a packaged manner upon request from customers. So I see this as I'm trying to figure out where these customers would fit in. They are commercial providers. Examples would be Domain Tools, who provides a huge swath of historical information relating to this space we call the Internet. It's perhaps the only party who maintains historical data regarding registrations as far back as the mid-1990s. So I'm trying to find out how my clients fit into this proposal. It seems as though this proposal was driven largely from two points of reference. One is data protection, and the other one is an attempt to centralize the Who Is, which currently is a very decentralized system, with centralization being provided by third-party for-profit entities and some non-profit entities who have, over the past 20-odd years, developed their business models surrounding the current situation, the current state of affairs. So my first question in terms of data privacy is that not best addressed at the point of input? So allowing the user, the registrant, whose interests you are purporting to protect, to determine the privacy that they wish to achieve with their particular information. If you register the information and don't opt out, or you opt into the public sector, then your record is opted in, the same as if I bought a house in London under my own name. And it would be forever there. I could not go back and decide on Tuesday that I didn't want my records from 10 years ago to exist in relation to this residence. The second thing is, I don't see a space in your authorization mechanism to fit third-party commercial entities. I just don't see one. We're not a research for the public benefit. We're a commercial enterprise, such as Domain Tools. Any other, the registrar data, there are a considerable number of registrars out there who do not power their own Who Is, who rely upon third-party commercial services to, in fact, power their Who Is systems. So I would like to see the panel addressed that particular issue so as not to carve out and not to unilaterally destroy, or as a community, destroy a member of this community, a significant member of this community, who's been active and participating for the last 30 years. Thank you.
Fab, do you want to take it? And then anybody else on the panel wants to.
Hey, Paul, thank you for asking that. So it's actually something we discussed for probably at least a year or a couple months into the year and a half. I know that the earlier drafts that we put out said that the system should accommodate for ancillary services. I think that developed into specifically identifying reverse who is and who was services. And so I think you need to look at it from a perspective of we didn't hopefully carve that out. We just didn't explicitly tie the bridge between what Susan said, which is that we tried to encapsulate the universe of permissible purposes, but we didn't. We may have not captured all of them. I doubt we did, as you're probably pointing out right now, and as Steve pointed out on the news services and free speech. So if you marry with the fact that you could add a permissible purpose through the community dialogue and marry to that to the explicit statement that the system is and should be built to accommodate reverse who is and who was, I think that solves what you're talking about. And so really it's just an issue of, in the report, we just didn't explicitly tie the system should be built in this way and that specific purpose. So I would just say it's something that I'm glad you're bringing up now, because it clearly identifies a place where it just needs further, further work.
I appreciate that, but the groups that, for example, brand protection, security, customers of domain tools, for example.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
Well, they don't use domain tools for the linear purpose that you're describing.
Well, I'm
so, hold on. Yeah, so two things. First of all, we're going to get down into the weeds on this, okay. But Rod wants to respond, so let Rod respond.
Yeah, actually, Principle 50 actually addresses this directly. We actually did put this into the document. I'm sorry to correct you. this is a big document, and there's been a lot of discussions. And we're actually looking at this as an opportunity to have within the framework an ability for third-party services like Domain Tools and Mark Monitor and others that have provided these services over the years in some legal gray area to be able to at least interact with the system going forward. It's important to realize that you have to have permissible purposes in order to gather and display that information. As long as the third parties or whoever is involved are able to work and interact within that framework, they should be able to do that. And that's the way that we've tried to design this document, to allow for that without precluding those kinds of services, but at the same time recognizing that you still have to provide the same kind of protections, et cetera, through some sort of third-party service as you would directly with the RDS itself, right?
Granted, but if your goal of protection, which you're using the word, if the goal of protection is to protect the privacy rights of the registrant, why not give that and empower the registrant to make that determination instead of trying to make it for them?
Because that's...
Because
we decided not to do that. we have done it effectively, but not in the way that you've said. But I think you've... Sir.
Hi, Chris Parsons. I'm a postdoctoral fellow with the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. I have three classes of questions, and I don't know how long they are, but they're significant. The first... addresses to an alarm going. The first relates to individual protection. I think that the idea that you have a protected gating system for individuals you identify at risk is very positive. However, it's only positive when you know or believe or suspect that you will be a person at risk. It is incredibly often that journalists are no longer with a Reuters badge, a New York Times badge, or something like that. They're a blogger, they've registered a website, they've traveled somewhere in the world, and then they realized, when they landed, when they're seized, when they're detained, I am a person of interest. Humans, on an individual basis, do not have the capability to ascertain if what they say needs to be protected based on where they travel. In some cases they can, in others they can't. So my question, my first, is how do you account for that threat model?
Why do you need a domain name?
That's not the point.
Yeah, it is the point, because it is a point. It is a point. Well, I thought he finished his question.
Had you finished your question?
But that's not the point.
Well, so we're now having a dialogue, which I thought this was supposed to be about, Milton, but thanks. Do you have to register a domain name, though, to do what you're saying, is what I'm asking you?
I'm saying you don't know. If I'm a university student at the University of Toronto and I write about the King of Myanmar in an inappropriate way, should I have known about that 10 years before I flew to Myanmar? I don't think that you... Insulting the king in that case can lead to charges. So I'm saying that people can become at risk.
That's true.
And the ability to query through a law enforcement purpose to identify who that individual is, they will not have known ahead of time that they were needing the protected credentials.
So what would the solution be?
I'm raising the question, have you considered this as your threat model in identifying what a protected person is, and then how would you preemptively do that?
You need the microphone, Carlson.
Yes. We can't anticipate it for you in as much as you can't anticipate, but what we do is provide the possibility of being protected. So that is the reason for the secured protected credentials. If you anticipate something is going to be happening to you, you avail yourself of that. If you don't, and at some point you change your mind, you come back to it, and you, as we say in Jamaica, you wheel around and come again. There's no other way to do it. You either anticipate it, and if you anticipate, there is a way to do it. And if you didn't anticipate it, and at some point down the road you figure you might need it, then you come around again. So that's the only other way.
Why not have that as the default then?
I'm sorry?
Why not have it as the default?
Because there are probably another 100 million reasons why that would not be the standard normal way to use a data website or a domain name.
Okay, that's fine. The next was, so something that we heard in this panel, which I appreciated, was accountability, logging, an effort to identify who is accessing records, and an ability for individuals to ascertain if their records were being queried. And I think that's a very positive step, and it's very important. However, it stands at variance from what was discussed in the LEA session earlier. In that session, there was a discussion where Interpol would act as a proxy service. There would be no way for an individual at some point in the future to know who had been querying their data. Various jurisdictions have right of request. There are expectations that individuals will have an ability to challenge requests for their personal data. I was wondering how this system accommodated that.
Well, given that none of us were in the...
I was the one who gave the LEA presentation this morning. So as I said at the time, the data would be... The queries would be logged by the RDS system, whoever the operator is, what have you. Their queries could be proxied through an Interpol or somebody like that, who is also responsible for knowing who is using that data amongst which law enforcement agencies, et cetera, so that if the if there's abuse detected at the RDS level, it could be pushed down through the responsible, then this whole idea around accrediting the accreditators, would be able to then at that point deal with an abuse issue directly with whatever the law enforcement agency that was doing whatever they weren't supposed to be doing. So there's the idea is that there's a way for people to proxy queries through, but they're still accountable for the activities that are going on within their accreditation sphere.
And at some point, would there be some notification to the end user that the data had been accessed?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
At some point, would there be a method within the framework you're developing for the individual to be notified?
The individual to be notified?
That their data had been accessed?
Their data had been accessed at all, yes. Yes. Now, because of the sensitivities around, in particular, law enforcement, they may not know exactly who and exactly when. That's all a matter of policy decision. But that information has to be tracked, and over time, that information would have to be released in some sort of process. The question is timeliness, level of granularity, et cetera. And that's all. We produced a framework for in which to do that. There's a lot of dicey policy questions that are going to have to get down to the nitty-gritty on how that might work. But I think that the thing you're looking for is possible within the framework we're talking about. It just has to be dug into.
stepping up and say, and I think it's important to understand that we had to try and maintain a fine balance between how much detail to go into, and we've tried to talk at the principal level on the basis that that there is a policy development process that needs to take place to actually build the policies around it. So I think it's important that, you know, we are talking at a principal level, and the granularity is a real challenge, and a real balance with this is to how much if we did too much, we'd be accused of mandating policy, which is not what we're trying to do. Stephanie wanted to make a comment, and then I'll come back to you, because you said you had a third.
I have just one more, yeah.
Okay, Stephanie?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that. I made a rather flippant comment that the rules engine would be quite a challenge to build, and let me just respond in terms of Canada, which you know quite well, Chris. And there's a big section in our data protection legislation about when the individual has a right of access, Section 9. The Civil Liberties Group is planning to take it to the Supreme Court. Whatever happens with that, it would impact what was in the rules engine in terms of the timeliness, exactly what your rights are in terms of knowing what law enforcement access.
For the person in Canada.
Sorry?
For the person in Canada.
For the person in Canada.
Which is why the country.
Or the registry in Canada.
Or the registry in Canada.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one more, sir.
Yeah, and you might have a very quick, snappy response. This is to Stephanie. I'm just interested in her insight. Again... in Canada, we recently had a Supreme Court decision that recognized a basic right to anonymity and established very high thresholds in order to get access to data, which would arguably include that in a who-is system, which would include a warrant from a judge. So in light of the Supreme Court ruling, would the rules engine then require, when someone went to Interpol or whatever the proxy happens to be, would Interpol then be responsible for evaluating the legal standards of the country who is asking for the data to make sure that the law enforcement officer...
So, I know you want to respond, but let me just respond as a lawyer. You have to be a little bit careful I think the answer to your question from a legal point of view would be yes, provided that it's actually legislation. There are decisions made, overturned all the time. That becomes complicated. But if it's defined under the legal system in the territory, whatever it may be, if it's a common law system, etc., right? It may well be so, but Stephanie...
Chris, as you know, our government responded to the Supreme Court decision by not amending the legislation that is currently on the table. The legislation that the Supreme Court was responding to was, of course, the Charter, so it's law. So we would have to build that in, just as in the United States we'd have to build in whatever was there. And that's the kind of thing that is already... agonized over in the Budapest Convention with the instruments flowing out of that.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Robin Gross, and I'm interested in hearing about the dissenting opinion to the report that hasn't been published yet. I was encouraged to hear earlier this afternoon that dissenting opinion will be published forthcoming, so I look forward to seeing that. Stephanie, as the author of that dissenting report, perhaps you could tell us what led you to draft and publish that, what your concerns were. Thanks.
So I've got Stephanie. Obviously, no problem in you replying. Just if I could just remind everybody that you're still working on it. We're still talking about it. So we will. There is another session on Wednesday morning. But you go ahead.
Basically, there are a number of things that I had problems with. The precipitating factor was the consent clause, and I can't remember the number just off the top of my head, but basically there is a requirement in there that individuals be given an opportunity to consent to the use of their contact data. This is in the restricted area for all permissible purposes. And in my view, number one, you can't pull out one provision of data protection law and make it sort of a cameo. without the others. So consent has to be freely given. It has to be, you know, you have to have an option to consent or not. And it's clear that you don't have an option because of certain other principles that reinforce that, saying you either consent or you back out of the registration. Well, you know, that's a bit of an issue from a consent perspective. So that caused me to also worry about a number of things about the gated data. And so there's a few issues surrounding the gated data. The fact that you are consenting to all permissible purposes, we've heard a lot about the different purposes and how you are accredited for this purpose, not that purpose, and, you know, how transmutable your accreditation is. That all has a bearing in data protection implementation. So there's a lot of questions there. And that's a reflection of just some of the details that aren't all worked out yet. It's not a reflection of the report itself. Okay, and then the third thing, and you've heard quite a bit about how things are inside the gate or outside the gate, and in this presentation we've got a big focus on it in the slides. The language in the report, in my view, is still confusing. And if I'm confused, with all due modesty, and I've been saying this for several weeks now, and people are probably ready to argue with me, I'm not stupid. If I don't understand it, there's a good chance somebody else isn't going to understand it. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to that. I'd like to see that language changed so that it was more clear, so you wouldn't get the idea that public actually is published within the gate. That's a little confusing.
And I think it would be fair, Stephanie, to say, wouldn't it, that in our discussions we have established that there is, at least I think we have, I hope we have, that there is a difference between that a dissent piece is not, I think the text is unclear. That is something that we would handle with editorial tweaking, and it's not necessary to publish. In other words, we would, as a result of some comments that you might make, make some editorial changes to the report, and that deals with the last point. And I think it's also, so we're talking about that, and I think it's also fair to say, Stephanie, that there's not been any issue with any of us, with you having, you know, the right to dissent. And especially in respect to the conflict piece, the consent piece, which we understand your view on. So let's did you want to say something?
Yeah, just a simple thing. We discussed these three issues that Stephanie just explained yesterday within EWG, and I think we are very, very close to make it correct such a way it's put in context, so the wording has been discussed. We are fully, in fact, not excited, this is probably too much, but we are very, very happy that if there's some divergent view, we are very explicitly authorizing and promoting this divergent view, because we cannot say that this is accommodating everything. So this is one thing, and I believe with what we discussed yesterday, very soon, hopefully the sooner the better, we are going to be able to post something. I mean, Stephanie will be able to put in the blog the response for this one and the dissent. So I think this issue will be solved. Yes, this has been very much precipitated. I think it was maybe a question of time, hard work from everyone. So everyone is very nervous, and I miss the mark here, and if someone is responsible for this one, this is myself, because I thought it was not giving justice to everyone within EWG to have the full understanding of the context of this dissent. That's what has happened.
Very briefly, I'm afraid this whole dissent thing has unleashed a monster, because it was suggested to me early on that I could dissent on, put my thing up on my own blog, and I don't have a blog, and I always used to say that people who blog must be, you know, don't have a life. So I was talking to Mikey O'Connor about this, and he said, well, you ought to have your own name. You don't even have your own name registered. So not being a domainer, I really didn't care about it. Anyway, I now have my own domain, stephanieperrin.com, And I realized as Mikey was walking me through how to blog that I'm going to love this. And I've got like five other topics I want to blog on. Don't worry like that,
so
Chris. It's not all I can.
We have created a monster, Steph.
Indeed, you have. It's fun and it's not hard. So I'm going to put it. My thoughts up there.
I think, Stephanie, that just to be clear, we're fine. The working group is fine with whatever you do with your blog. What we want to do is to get a piece that we can actually put in the report. And that's not necessarily the same as it would look like on your blog. That's really the key. Okay, let's move on.
Okay, I just had one other question, and this one's to the whole panel. How will you determine whether the purpose that an accredited actor puts down is actually correct?
You mean for them to be validated to have access?
Yes.
Or the
that's simply through accreditation. During accreditation, the requester has to indicate his purpose, and that purpose has to be validated before giving credentials.
Okay.
Robin? Did that answer your question? It did? Okay, cool.
Can I follow up to Robin's question?
Are you not next in the queue anywhere?
I am, but I have a different question. Kathy Kleiman, non-commercial.
I'm not going to keep you to one question, Kathy, so it's okay.
I intend to be in line again and again, so I appreciate the two-hour block. First of all...
Well, let me just say that if we're only here in this room because of you, you may find that everybody else is gone. Go ahead.
First, I think you should all be wearing T-shirts that say, I survived the EWG.
Absolutely.
These are, as a member of the Who Is Review team, these are long, long processes. And thank you for your time, effort, creativity. And so just in follow-up to Robin's question, let me ask, you accredit the Chinese law enforcement, or Interpol accredits the Chinese law enforcement, which is a member of Interpol, and then China comes onto this massive centralized database and wants to look for everyone running certain types of pro-democracy websites critical of China, and they're looking in jurisdictions outside of China, particularly jurisdictions with free speech, freedom of expression protections. How do you stop that?
Rod?
So the good news on that is Interpol already has a protocol for exactly this, because this happens in the real world, or the existing world of law enforcement as it is today, where the Chinese or whoever, pick your favorite country, asks about people in another country that they have interests in. Now, the Interpol has a job of coordinating those communications and evaluating how their current systems are being used in order to learn about suspects or persons of interest in other countries today. They, for example, will be very helpful in solving international sex trade types of things, or pedophiles, or the like, but they are not supportive of, typically, people going and doing those kinds of witch hunts you're talking about. And they have protocols for that, and frankly, whoever is making such requests is at risk of losing their access to the entire Interpol system by making such requests, right? So they have a tracking system for taking a look at the kinds of requests that are coming through. Will everything be perfect on everything and every request? No. I mean, we know that, right? There's human beings involved, et cetera. But there is a framework for that.
The Interpol Convention applies to this. This could be different types of standards for accreditation.
Sure, which is about, and that's a very fair point, and goes back to the point about what other work needs to be done, either in the policy development process itself or before the GNSO starts a policy development process.
And just to follow up on that, is that what we've proposed here is to try and take advantage of existing systems and existing protocols for deconflicting these exact types of issues that are already out there, that are already being used. One of the things we found out by doing this work, and I learned a lot about how law enforcement works, and I thought I knew quite a bit, is that there are a lot more systems, a lot more accreditation schemes, a lot more providers of these kinds of services, and the frameworks in with which to operate them that have been in existence for years and decades that we can take advantage of for doing something as simple as WHOIS lookups.
Just one point I wanted to add to that is, you know, we gave a lot of thought about the IP address. Is that included in this? You know, that's tracked by the registrars, and should that be a data element included in the new data that's provided for a domain registration? And we decided collectively no. But really, an IP address might get you to that person you're looking for much quicker than a gated data record with a proxy registration that, you know, I mean, you could put lots of layers, and if you do know that you are one of those people making statements that you're going to be targeted, then the secure protected credential. So, you know, I think we did give it a lot of deep thought. Is it perfect? Probably not. I don't know what is perfect, but we are also looking for that community input. Not we, but the community will look for that input as this goes out to whatever PDP structure. And so these are high-level principles to guide the community, because we've had the luxury of really thinking deep about this. But then the community, you, Kathy, needs to be there to make sure the implementation of this process, if it's decided, goes in the direction that's safest for the community.
I'm still on the high-level principles and asking questions about them. So let me go back to my original question, which was, first, I've got two reports here. One is the interim report that was about, 84 pages or so, and the final report, which is double that length. So if you're looking, if you see people looking confused, it's a lot of material that came
in. It's a larger font.
A lot of material.
Please ignore Chris.
And confusing, a lot of material to absorb, and kind of wondering how we go from a draft to a final with so much more detail. And let me ask about one of the details, and then I'll get back in line to ask about others. And it has to do with the contacts, and let me flip over here. And what contacts are mandatory, what contacts are optional? When we talked in Singapore, we talked about optional contacts that were being added because large companies wanted them. Large companies did not want their technical contact contacted about abuse. They didn't want their abuse contact contacted about legal matters. But to impose all of those contacts on every registrant seems extreme. Here with a consolidated centralized database we've talked about from the beginning, it should be streamlined and narrower, not massively expanded.
But hang on, surely you could just go, I mean, so we do this in Australia, so surely you just go, I'm a small business, it's just me. I'll fill every box.
But Chris, legal contact means something, and it assumes something. When we use it in the United States, it assumes you've got an expert. And every registrant may not be that expert for themselves.
Okay, so I accept that the term.
Well, it's a mandatory field, Susan, and it's public.
Hold on.
No, that's she's not disagreeing with you about that.
It is a mandatory field.
Can you take the microphone?
Just listen. We acknowledge it's public, not a problem. I also acknowledge that it may be in certain jurisdictions the term legal contact may have a specific meaning, and that's fine. But you know, the point is, what it's meant to be is the contact. If somebody comes into the system, goes through all of the hoops, etc., and has designated that the purpose they are looking for the data is because it's a legal issue, they would be given the legal contact. What that enables my business to do is to designate, should I wish to do so, that my lawyer is listed in the legal contact. But it's equally possible, as a small business, as we do all the time in the box ticking exercises that we go through, that I might put myself in every single box. In the same as you do right now, you go to Who Is Look At It Now, you'll see a lot of individuals, they're the tech contact, they're the admin contact, they're every contact. So is the problem that it's called a legal contact? Or is the problem that I have to fill it in? What's the...
First, box ticking exercises are very dangerous. And second, legal contacts mean things. But third, let me get to my real concern, which is that when you look at legal-based contacts, you have, at least I'm looking at page 52 of 166, it has the name, the street address, the country, the phone number, all mandatory, all public.
No.
And...
No.
And that's, so at least that's how I see it, because I have the original.
I think this is part of the confusion that Stephanie was mentioning before.
Can I just finish my sentence and then please, I'd love to hear your response. But if this is mandatory in public, first, it's a huge change from the interim report, and second, it's very dangerous because it looks as if the registrant would have, it looks as if the only group that's left with protection is corporations.
So that's not correct.
Okay, this is to Jean-François.
And I think we are very pleased that you asked this question, because this has been in the corridor many times, the question to me and to every one of us. And this one, it is written onto this one. It is, of course, not perfect things, but it is part of what we just mentioned before with Stephanie on the sometimes misleading wording that we put into this one. This will be clarified, but let me...
Will you be changing
page? No, let me talk first. So there is data that could be public through a purpose-driven, you know, I mean, you have to go in, you have to ask for it based on a specific purpose. So that... those elements, those data elements, could become public at any time.
Disclosed.
Yes. They're disclosed, but it would become available to an individual, third party. And so, but there are also data elements that we're recommending collecting that are discretionary. So those are only disclosed if the registrant agrees to that. So there's sort of three levels of data. Do I think this report is absolutely clear? No. Do I think we did a really good job in trying to make sure that people would know that this data they are providing could be disclosed?
That was it.
Yeah. It took me a while to get there.
Yeah, no, I was talking about the slides.
Oh, okay. So,
Kathy, okay, that is what is publicly disclosed, So let's be clear.
Will you be editing page 52?
Well, I...
No.
There's an FAQ that clarifies what that table means. It says public, and it said optional and gated in the interim report.
So this is a process question? Are we going to edit page 52? We're not. The report is published, right? We will add addendums, explanations, etc., for to clarify these kinds of issues. And there's many of them. There are in lots of spaces where this kind of exactly this dialogue. What do you mean by this? How does this work? Because there are it is in there, and its different principles are point to how this works, whether it's public or not.
Because it looks like you're under. We totally
get that. We understand that, and we're going to put out a clarification around this so that it is clear to you and everybody else that has this issue, which has been one brought up by many.
We do have three levels of data.
Is that you don't actually believe us? So I need you to understand that we are very, very clear. That is the open. Public, if you want to call it public, data. Anonymous, yes. Sorry, outside of the gate. Now, is it mandatory to provide a lump of data? Because you used two words. You said mandatory and public.
Right.
Yes, it is mandatory. However, it was subject to proxy and stuff. But if that page, and I haven't looked at that page for a while, if that page gives you the impression that your address would be displayed publicly,
right.
The answer is it will not, and we will ensure that there is a clarification so that you are comfortable that that is the case.
I would appreciate that.
Thank you. Okay, good.
Thank
Thank you. Wendy Seltzer here, speaking with some high-level questions and some very detailed questions, taking the opportunity of having the panel in front of me to answer some questions that I haven't yet been able to parse reading this 160-plus page report. The high-level question is, did the group discuss that, you know, what this report does fundamentally changes the nature of domain name ownership? It imposes sort of new accountability requirements on the owner of a domain name that make it impossible simply to have a domain name for the purpose of having a stable location for online speech and DNSSEC signature in the root, key in the root, rather, through which they can secure communications, and instead adds additional information that every user must supply as a condition of domain name ownership.
Wendy, you've registered domains, haven't you?
Yes.
Okay. You are subject to the registration agreement you have with your registrar and also subject to the UDRP. There's a degree of accountability at the moment.
Yes, and I believe that's different from...
Hold on. No, please, hold on. There's accountability now. It's just not as clear. I don't see this as being a seismic shift. I mean, it might be clearer and easier for people to understand that there's a degree of accountability. But if I go off and I register a domain name now and infringe on somebody's trademark or something like that, I can lose the domain, be that via URS or a UDRP. If I go off and I register a domain name and I use that solely for the purpose of distribution of malware or something like that, the domain could be pulled either at the registry level or the registrar level. There is accountability.
Thanks, and I'm not suggesting that any of those...
But
the accountability doesn't hinge on the registration of the domain name, but about misuses either in the registration or use of the name, but not in the holding of a non-infringing name itself.
I'm not sure.
So, Wendy, if I could just add to what Michele said. So, I agree, we actually amped up accountability a lot. But actually, for those who hold, display, disperse, transfer, seek data, I don't think there was a seismic shift in those who registered domains, because just to add to Michele, at least I didn't see it, so hopefully I'm not speaking outside of turn, because when I've registered a domain, I'm assuming you saw the same registration agreement, which says specifically in a clause that you agree to put accurate data, and then in the UDRP it actually has accompanying clauses. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons under every TOS I've ever seen in 14 years that says that your domain name can be suspended or deleted at the discretion of the registrar for putting in inaccurate data. So when we amped up accountability for all of those people seeking that data that's supposed to be accurate, we didn't think we were doing a seismic shift for the registrant, because the registrant's already under that obligation.
Sorry, Wendy. I mean, if you can explain to me a little bit better what you see as being significantly different. I mean, I'd really like to know. It's just...
Maybe let Wendy try and do that then.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit confused. If there is something that we have done that gives the impression that we've... that's a massive change, please, I really would like to know. But I think all we've really done is highlighted the concept of there being accountability, which was already there, but maybe it wasn't being enforced. I don't know.
I think you've required additional data elements. You've required validation of data elements, not just the input of accurate data elements. You've imposed some of that accountability on the domain ownership as opposed to domain use or display of a string that infringes trademark.
I'm not sure there are any additional data elements. There might be additional in the sense of you weren't asked to provide a legal concept before, but if you just look at the actual data elements, there aren't any additional ones. And if validation, sorry?
That are required. There's plenty of optional ones that we put in.
Yes. And then the validation doesn't really change.
It changes the cost. It changes the cost of providing the service and therefore the cost of the service that will likely be provided.
I think that that's a great point of discussion. I mean, in the year and a half that we brought in vendor after vendor after vendor after vendor, not one of them actually made that point. And that's a very valid point that you're bringing up. So I'd love to see the data on that so we can actually put it into the PDP process of the discussion, because the one thing we tried very much to avoid and why we have 166 pages, why we put in 180 principles, why I spent personally a year and a half of my life traveling around the world was to make sure that we tried to unturn every stone and actually not base anything here on assumptions. And so I think it's very dangerous to try to assume those things without the backing data. So if you have it, please give it to us so we can incorporate it through the process.
I've been at plenty of earlier public forums where the costs of validation were discussed. And so I imagine some of you were as well.
Sorry, just to add to this. I mean, I don't disagree with you that there is a cost of validation. I'm a registrar. I'm very aware of that. Unfortunately, the 2013 REA introduced some verification, and then there's also the validation, which hasn't been fully implemented yet. Now, if we could make that all go away completely out of my contract, I probably wouldn't be complaining about it, but you know, the reality is it's there. We did have discussions with several companies looking at some of the validation and you know the costs associated with that. And you know, the thing I think is that some of the costs exist in the system now. Some of the costs are borne by the registrars, some costs are borne by the registries, some costs are borne by third parties. So at the moment there are costs there all over the place. Like dealing with a WHOIS accuracy complaint costs me time and money. If that went away, I would be quite happy. And I'm not only dealing with a very small volume of them.
Very quickly, Rod, because Wendy, I know, has other things she wants to talk about, so let's...
Yeah, I just point out, we had proposals or discussions with UPU and Secure Domain Foundation. Secure Domain Foundation is offering validation for free, so I don't know how you can get lower costs than that to registrars. And then the other thing is the concept of the validators, in theory, should lower costs because you can actually localize that. So if I'm GoDaddy or what have you, or any registrar in any country, I can now use a validator that's in a third, you know, in a country where I don't have people who speak that language or know the guy who lives in that place over here actually is that person or what have you, and that should lower costs by introducing more ways to do the validation than currently exist.
Wendy?
All right, I'll be brief in additional comments. You make reference to a privacy policy and risk analysis, both of which are recommended, and I very much look forward to seeing those done before all of this collection infrastructure
So we've asked the GNSO to give us a list, so make sure you get those put on the list. Perfectly fine.
And finally, one of the technical questions that occurs to me reading this: can a registrant have a distinct ID for each place his contact appears, even if it's the same contact data?
Do you mean if I choose to put my name into the legal contact and the tech contact, can I have two separate IDs?
Yes.
Yes, I would.
Yes. You can choose to have multiple contact ID. That's up to you.
Every piece of information is the same, yet it gets different ID number every place it appears.
I think you have the choice, Wendy. I mean, if you want to, I think I know where you're coming from. In your concern would be that by reverse engineering the ID, you can work out patterns, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. So if you want to create multiple IDs for yourself, I don't think there's any real issue with that. The thing is that for, let's say, for my company, we have domain names registered. I would prefer to be able to just have, you know, one ID, because it's not like I have a staff of millions.
But you're allowed to have more.
So, but there's no reason why you wouldn't be able to have multiple. It's not an issue.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Much like personalities, Wendy. Many as you want. Rob.
Hi, Rob Golding from Astutium. We're a registrar. I'm particularly looking forward to reading Stephanie's blog. I'm concerned about you now having a domain name, though. You're here at ICANN. You're, you know, on the panel. I now know where you live. I can go and borrow that 50-inch plasma TV that you've got while you're in London. So hopefully you've taken some sort of privacy protection on that and hidden that data. I have waded through the original interim report and part of the final report, and I have similar questions to an earlier one. It isn't very clear what is mandatory, what is optional, what is declared, what is not declared, what public really means. Is there going to be a final version of that, which is a lot clearer? Because we have to know what to supply. We have to know what we get permission from our customers for.
So let's be really clear. First of all, this is a report, and it's not policy. It's just a report. Secondly, if we receive feedback, which we have done, that something is unclear, we will fix it. Whether we choose to fix it by republishing the report or putting a tech, it doesn't much matter for the sake of discussion. What matters is it will be fixed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just speaking here, Rob, if it's, you know, something like that, maybe some kind of matrix type thing might work. I mean, the thing I think around this is we put out, the feedback we got from interim stuff that we'd published and sessions was, you know, give us more detail, which is part of the reason why it went from, 88 odd pages to 166. No, Cathy, it wasn't a big conspiracy to upset you. Honest. Maybe adding some kind of matrix or something like that, which would make it clearer. Personally, I'm all for that. I mean, some of the feedback we've had from people to date has been, you know, there's a certain lack of clarity, and that wasn't intentional. That was more just, if you've been eating, sleeping, drinking, and probably having nightmares and dreams about this stuff, it might be a bit hard to, you know, kind of distance yourself enough to realise that it wasn't 100% clear to others.
Yeah. There were comments earlier regarding commercial use of the data, particularly around people like Domain Tools,
yeah,
who aggregate the only two decentralised GTLDs. They're mostly centralised anyway. What provisions are in there, if at all, or recompensing the registrants for their personal data? People are currently used to exchanging their name and address in order for free use of Facebook. They understand that their personal data, and it is protected under UK law, we're in the UK, has a value.
Yeah.
What payments are going to be made for registrants who choose to allow their data in this system?
I'm sorry, I actually genuinely don't understand the question. You enter into a bargain where you go to buy a domain name, and then
yes,
there's a series of systems and rules in place in respect to the data that is declared. There's governing law. I don't understand.
Are you suggesting
that the data would be sold?
Well, you're one of the suggestions is that the commercial entities, let's just pick on Domain Tools because we know.
But
that,
I don't think. I mean, were we talking
are going
about
to
selling?
Mine this data or represent?
Are we talking
data?
About selling the data? I'm not sure.
Is what he's talking about, I believe, and I mean,
that's
sorry,
you're
Rob.
Here,
sorry, I'm used to exchanges with Rob, so I kind of speak semi-fluent Rob Golding. I think what Rob's talking about is third-party access,
yeah,
third-party bulk access to data in order for services such as Domain Tools to exist.
Yeah.
I think that's all he's asking about.
Or the solicitor earlier who provides reports to his customers,
yeah,
about infringements and things. Well, my address has a value. Tesco's will pay me £27 per year to mobile rights.
Yes, but I don't need to go to Tesco's to find your address right now.
You don't.
Assuming you've complied with the terms of your contract.
I have.
Actually,
I have. I've lifted an address you can post.
Exactly.
To
fair enough.
Not my address.
Fair enough. But isn't that the point?
I think Fabrizio was dealing with that. Was it Rod? Somebody the access. For Domain Tools and other companies.
Right, it's in the report, number 50, I think, was
yep,
the number. And the key there is that if you had third-party access to the data of any sort, it would still have to fall under the same principles around how it's treated, how access is done. It has to be done very carefully, and that you wouldn't have bulk access so that people could go spam you or whatever the heck they'd been doing for the last 10, 15 years with this stuff. So we carved out a way for that to occur. How that actually gets written up and enforced is a part of the policy of development that has to go forward.
I think that's right. I mean, I'll come to you in a second. I think there's a dichotomy between the current situation, which is that those businesses exist because they have open access to the data, and you're put to inconvenience in order to not have the real, not real, but you know what I mean, data out there. And what we're talking about, which is effectively turning that on its head, but still trying to find a way of enabling those sorts of things, those innovative, let's call them innovative things to happen. That's not, we haven't done that. We have not specifically said how that should be. What we've said is the community should think about whether it is a permissible use to have that access. Yes, Fab, you can. Stephanie, I know you want to come in.
Sorry, Stephanie. I don't mean to jump the line. I just want to say, in conjunction with what you said with the community, consider and evaluate this. Please do, when you consider this, that one of the reasons we've left it the way it is in the report is that I don't want to, you know, I personally, and I'm sure the group, does not want to promise you or Milton or anybody else certain layers of systematically applied privacy and data protection rules, and then allow somebody into the system that then makes a carbon copy of that data and loopholes everything we worked hard to do, and then violates that. So in essence, you may think you're entering a system where you say, I've been protected, there's accountability, people who access my data, it's purpose-driven, they, you know, there are all these checks and balances, and I don't know, where somebody goes into the system, pulls all the data, and then sells it, and they're going to sell it without any of those things that the community has bargained for so hard to protect people. And so that's why we were cautious. Again, we realize those data, that those services are out there. Hell, I'm subscription through my company of about two or three of them. So we're not trying to kill an ecosystem, but we also want to make sure that everything that everyone's fought for on privacy and data protection isn't circumvented.
Stephanie, I apologize for missing you out.
Some of these practices, even if they're long-standing and been around for 20 years, would not be permitted under data protection law, which is why the data protection policy has to be done first so that you can set the parameters, because a permissible purpose for some purposes may not be permissible as far as you're concerned as someone who has data protection rights.
Sure. Which comes back to your rules engine again, for the different people protected in different ways.
Yeah.
One more go.
I know Canada has reasonable privacy rules for individuals. I know Ireland's covered by the general EU. In the UK, certain information is considered to be private, and you can.
And you sound like a potential guest blogger, I have to say.
Thank you. I have to.
Now we're building a whole new Stephanie ecosystem. It's enough.
I have to deal with registrants and, you know, ask them to update their whois if we get a complaint. Thankfully, we don't generally get many, because as a registrar, we know who our customers are. In fact, as far as my personal opinion is that whois should just be turned off, because the only people who need to know who the registration is for are the registrars. But the overwhelming response I've had from existing registrants registering new TLDs and GTLDs is, why do they have to put their data out in the public anyway?
I agree. Same, exactly the same in Australia, same thing.
And just a stat for the panel. Since we made protection as a free service on all domains, simply because we want people to have the option, we've had 3 out of over 900 people turn it off and say they want their details public. 3 out of 900 in the last week.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Milton Mueller here, Syracuse University Internet Governance Project. I have 2 questions for you, assuming I can get to them without being interrupted by the moderator.
Thanks for the rhetoric, Milton.
Yeah, you might
super.
Actually,
I mean, if you want, we can take the microphone off the moderator.
Yeah, I think you should just put it down so that he actually has to reach for it before he can intervene. No, my first question is very fundamental. It's just assume I'm an ordinary individual domain name registrant. I don't have a company. I'm concerned about my privacy. Under the current system, if I'm concerned I either hire a registrar like the one he just described that gives me some protection, or I hire a proxy service. And if law enforcement needs to get behind that, they have some procedures for doing so, right? Tell me what your system, how your system makes my life better. Just my life, not the trademark lawyers, not the law enforcement, just my life.
As a registrant.
As a registrant.
All the processes you just mentioned are still in existence in the present RDS. The proxy service provider is still there. You can still use it. And there are purpose-based contacts, an option for you if you want to use. And if you don't want to use, you simply use your name as default. So to me, your life is much better now because you have more options, including the existing
my team oversees the domain registrations for Time Warner. Time Warner has multiple entities. At one point, we had, I think, 70,000 domain names. That's a little hard to manage. So how does that make my life easier? Well, one, when I go to register, I'm given options as to what I put in. I no longer have to have my name, my address, my email address, etc., then create a role account, then devise a technical account, because it all went to one person, right? That one person can just put their information and they're done. On top of it, once they proceed out of there, you do have privacy proxy. You can hire a registrar to do your stuff. But the reality is I've entered the information once. I can update it once. I can port it once like a phone number. So me as a registrant who had to manage 70,000 domain names, my life is much, much easier. For the simple user who has one or two, like myself as a person, who has used privacy proxy for all the reasons you would think, my life is easier again. Because I put in one time, then I do the checkbox exercise we talked about with Kathy, where I say, I want privacy proxy, check, 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 and I've been informed of all the purposes for which I might disclose that data, legal purposes, what have you. I say, domains by proxy, check, 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 and the only thing that gets published outside are details relating to domains by proxy. It becomes a much easier system to manage from a management perspective. And it doesn't change, though, the ecosystem of what you're talking about with privacy proxy, capability of having a registrar do things. And it shouldn't change the cost model with that perspective either.
Just one quick point as well. Me as an individual in the current system, I don't necessarily know how to designate something that I might not want to get bothered by. But I would still get bothered by it by the proxy solution if they just forward the email to me, right? Now I can say, well, for technical or abuse matters, GoDaddy is handling that for me, and they're offering us as a service or whatever registrar, right? So I can actually hand off some of the things that currently I might get bothered by and I don't want to deal with it. Even as just an individual domain holder.
It becomes much more transparent to someone, in particular the kind of first comer, at least the way we're envisioning it. Obviously, there's some implementation that has to go through from registrars, et cetera. But we honestly wanted it to be a lot more transparent to what it was you were, one, putting data in for and what that could be used for. And so, you know, I remember with Scott, we had a conference call, a year ago, where he was talking about he finds it a real pain in the butt when he has to go in and put in data for a registrant, data for an admin, data for a tech, and it was like, why do I have to go through that exercise?
Okay,
now
so,
you don't.
So basically, for an individual registering one name, there's not much of a difference. For multiple domains, it gets a little more efficient and so on. Anyway, that's all I want to hear about that, because I have another question that's actually more relevant to developing your report or policy out of your report.
Sorry, Milton, do you mind if I just add one thing with respect to your individual registrant thing? One thing that the system, there's a couple of things that the system does have that I think from a privacy perspective are a little bit more interesting. The idea of this rules engine that depending on which jurisdiction you're in, you'd get different levels of privacy protection. I think that's quite interesting. I mean, the devil's in the details. And
this sounds like hand-waving to me. I deliberately did not bring that up. The rules engine. Yeah, we'll put all the rules of the world into an engine. And it will magically protect you.
Well, the idea, I think, isn't a bad one. I mean, implementing it, I suspect, is going to be a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
But, I mean, ultimately, as we all know, at the moment there's a lot going on in this entire space around privacy, particularly here in Europe. So, you know, what is going to be required of us or not required of us as companies and as individuals over the next couple of years is going to change quite a bit. Okay. But if you look at the public data example, which I think is the one up on the screen at the moment, that's significantly less data that's being shared outside any kind of gate than is the current status. I mean, if you do a look up on any .org or .com, you get a hell of a lot more information. So I think in some respects it would be a significant improvement. Obviously, you know, you still have a lot of options open to you, be that using privacy, proxy, different services from different companies, individuals, whatever. I mean, you know, you still got all those options.
I know Stephanie wants to come in. So just quickly, Stephanie, and then Milton's got a second question.
I was just going to respond to Milton that if you your choice is to either move out of New York State or assign your very best postdoc to work on the privacy policy working group so that it's harmonized at a high level, because sadly everything McKaylee talked about wouldn't really apply to you.
Okay. So if you could put the slide about purposes up there, I don't know if it's hard to find.
Prescribed purposes?
Might be useful. So I was really...
That one?
Yeah. My understanding of your process was somebody is authorized to search the database and surveil people for specific purposes. And then when they make a query, they tell the system what that purpose is, and the purpose matches it against their accreditation, and then they're allowed or not allowed access to the data. This sounds to me, I mean, absurdly simple to lie to. I say, I'm looking for trademark protection. I'm a trademark lawyer. Maybe I really am. But I'm actually looking for an old girlfriend's domain name registration. And I tell it, you know, I'm smart enough that when it asks me what my purpose is, I tell it the wrong purpose. And how do you know what I'm really doing?
How are we doing? Basil, go ahead.
So, I mean, I think I can see what you're saying. I mean, and that's why we have, you know, audits in place. And one of the things that we talked about was the ability to put in behavioral and analysis and pattern analytical tools to be able to figure out if somebody's actually, you know, what are they doing? You know, they say they've got this purpose. They're going out to this, you know, they're doing something completely different. They say they were, you know, there's going to be a UDRP, and suddenly they're just fishing around or whatever. So. To some extent, you know, that is something that we've tried to address with some of these other features and mechanisms within the system to be able to capture that and then pull that in and do something about it within the RDS.
So in terms of implementation, you're saying that's something you'd like to do, but really you don't know how, and in terms of policy, that would be something to pay very careful attention to.
Well, Milton.
I think that's true. I mean, certainly from a policy point of view, Milton, I can speak from experience in Australia. We have certain policies that require you as the person asking us for information to warrant certain things to us. Now, I couldn't say to you that, you know, a person hasn't miswarranted, but I can tell you that we pick up patterns quite easily, and so a single use, a single misuse, I want a better term, because you're trying to find your ex-girlfriend, I might not pick up, but a continuing use for a purpose would be a lot easier to pick up.
Yes. In addition to that, the system makes provision for auditing. So, in the process, during the auditing process, you can be found out and consequences for misbehaviors.
And I think it's also fair to say that you can proxy behind a heap of stuff. Sorry, you can go behind a proxy for a lot of these purposes. And so therefore, you know, it becomes a narrower and narrower and narrower funnel if you choose to use the proxy services that your real information is available. In fact, it may not be at all. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's an RBAC system, right? So none of them are 100% going to guarantee that people, insiders, can won't abuse them. That will happen. I mean, that happens all the time with people and government officials looking up their ex-girlfriend or all that kind of stuff. It just, it does. And what we're trying to do is create a way for you to actually figure that out, which you can't do at all today, right? I can go look up my ex-girlfriend's domain names today with the fully available, anonymous, nobody's tracking anything system that there is. So, you know, at the end of the day, what we want to do is create a system where you can start enforcing some of those things that you're concerned about and then have penalties, obviously, sanctions, et cetera, for people who abuse that system. So they're denied access or reported to the authorities, what have you. You know, if that's stalking in some country, that actually might end up leading to a prosecution.
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, to summarize what Rod and I think what everyone's saying is that back to the basic question we were asked, is there a better alternative? And we said the resounding answer is yes. The question wasn't, is there a perfect alternative? Because the reality is there just isn't. And I totally get your point. And I think that to the extent that we can get input to try to correct those things, because that's what we're honestly trying to get at, right? We're relying on the fact that if someone at my company uses our token, they're going to realize that if they go look up their girlfriend and that girlfriend realizes the information was obtained via the Time Warner token through the Whois, they're likely going to get fired. Because when our token searching turns off for legitimate merger acquisition, asset management, et cetera, right? So at the end of the day, we're relying on an accountability structure, hopefully to blanket over the gaps that, you know, as Rod was saying, we just can't build. I mean, we don't know it. If we knew it, we'd put it out there. But there's just there's not a perfect answer to that.
Well, I think the dilemma is that you're creating this enormous global centralized surveillance system. And you're legitimately trying to build accountability and privacy protections into it, but at the same time, one has to question whether you should build the tool at all and whether we actually need that tool and whether it's worth the risks and the cost.
And look, in the times
Milton,
that...
Thank you. Hang on. Yes. Thank you, Milton. The scribes are asking if we could make sure to say who... Sorry, oh, okay. This is Chris. Could make sure you say your name before you speak.
So Fabrizio Vira. So the point of surveillance and aggregated, disaggregated, and all these discussions, I mean, we've talked about it a bunch. And, you know, when we hear the argument that aggregated is going to be more, much easier to crack and go in and get information from, you got to look at the fact that what we're arguing for is a system where the problem already occurred in a disaggregated model. Because last I checked, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, et cetera, are actually different companies, not under the same umbrella, and they themselves have disaggregated servers. What we were hoping, and maybe it's the wrong answer, but what we were hoping is that in an aggregated model where you can actually systematically apply tougher rules, tougher security, tougher privacy, tougher data protection rules, then it becomes tougher for people to crack that system, as opposed to a system today where it's just all you need is one weak link that then undoes the entire system of disaggregated models. So that was our attempt, and maybe we got it wrong, but that was our attempt.
Just very quickly, Carlton, because we have a...
Yes, I wanted to... this is Carlton, for the record. I wanted to address the issue of if we believe that for surveillance purposes you really have to get into the database to surveil, I think that's wrong. All you have to do is sit outside the gate. You don't have to be inside to surveil. And the surveillance issue is really a red herring. We always seem to forget that there is an infrastructure for this, huge infrastructure everywhere, hundreds of billions of dollars. They didn't put all that money in just to sit as a white elephant. And I don't believe that you're going to get away from somebody sitting on the ramp, off the ramp, on the highway, and listening and watching. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, sir.
I'm Kevin MacArthur. I'm with the Sierra Board, .ca operator. We are one of the registries that has actually done Whois privacy for individual registrants. And some of the challenges that we've had in doing that is the security of that information. So my question is, under what legal regime will the actual rules engine, the database, all that stuff operate? If it fails, who do I file suit with?
No one, because you shouldn't be allowed to. So it's a function of to some extent, it's a function of the country that you're in.
Well, no, this system has to exist somewhere. And
oh, I'm sorry. You mean where will we put it?
The actual system.
I apologize.
System,
right. I misunderstood. Poland? Oh, the moon. Oh, yeah, the moon. There you go. I mean, the answer is we don't yet. We have not made a recommendation of place. Although I'm sure that Jean-Francois would like to run it from his house.
We have principles, actually.
Yeah, we have principles. You're right.
Yeah, that it should be established in an area with high data protection, written in the law, and we said something about the law enforcement.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. But again, trusted law enforcement.
I'd encourage you to think about trusted law enforcement. Is better than it is now, because right now, what would the answer to the question be?
Well, in the Canadian context, the answer is we keep our registrant data private.
Yeah, but in a GTLD world, what would the answer be? Because this doesn't affect the Canadian. This doesn't affect .ca. So what would it be in a GTLD world right now?
Well, some of these domain names have not yet been approved in the new GTLD space, so we don't know what the data protection regime will be for those new GTLDs.
Sure, but my point is that where would you? Your question was, who would I sue?
Yeah. So the question, for example, if I'm in .Toronto or .Quebec and one of the new GTLDs affecting Canada,
right,
and the registrant's privacy is violated through failure of the rules engine or through the legal issues related to the jurisdiction in which the rules engine is operating.
Yes.
Who do I have redress with?
So, and I accept the question, and we've got a series of principles as to where the RDS should be located. But you still have the issue of where's your, irrespective of the RDS, you still have the question of where is your registrar? Where is your registry? Mm-hmm. And where's the registrant?
So this is my question, is where does that jurisdictional question
Well, it depends on all of those things.
What we tried to do was create a rules engine that actually accounts up and downstream for the jurisdiction of the data subject. So I can understand why you're talking about where the RDS actually sits, but hopefully it kind of assuages those concerns, knowing that what we're really trying to implement is not based on where the data sits, but who the data subject is and where they sit. So if I'm doing a search from, say, the U.S. to Canada, the rules engine would actually apply the laws, the privacy and data protection laws of your jurisdiction, so that I don't get data that I'm not supposed to get merely because I'm searching from outside your jurisdiction.
To the extent it goes through the rules engine, not around. Right?
It would, and again,
so
that,
in the American context, which is where I would be concerned with the U.S. ICANN, the American context of the national security letters and things of that nature, that would be.
But ICANN's not going to be controlled by data, though.
Pardon?
ICANN doesn't control the data.
So it controls the rules engine.
No. The idea is that the idea is that it's independent.
Right. But you just point out exactly, circle back to the question we had about ancillary service providers and circumventing those rules.
Yeah. Stephanie? Sorry, I apologize, Carlton. Stephanie first, then Carlton.
I just wanted to say that getting back to how complex that rules engine is, I mean, if you are a traveling Belgian citizen living in New York State, just to pick on Milton's home state, you still have data protection rights, and this is going to be extremely complex to figure out where your registry is, that's why we want a high level of harmonized data protection, so that we can build that into the rules engine. If you're, a rabid privacy advocate such as me, you want a high level policy that then gets reflected in the rules engine, so that we don't have to tease these pieces apart, because it's a real nightmare.
In an ideal world, and I think I agree with you, Stephanie, in an ideal world, what you'd do is you would have a policy that was at a level that was acceptable. Let's just say Ireland. Forget the Europeans for a minute. European Commission. Just say Ireland.
No, anywhere but Ireland, please,
okay,
Chris.
Okay, all right.
What do you have against Ireland?
Let's say Canada, right? And then the only question you then have is, are there any jurisdictions that are not prepared to accept that level of privacy, which is possible, or are there any jurisdictions that insist on a greater level of privacy, which is possible? So the key for the policy development is to come up with your benchmark, and then all you have to do is move up and down either way. Carlton, you wanted to say something.
Well, I think it's Carlton. You took it away, Chris, because I was saying the principles. We have some principles, and we said collection, disclosure, and transfer stayed with the data subject. So those principles of protection stays with them. Now, it's about the handling of the data now where you have the rules engine. You can have an engine that by data subject and the rights that come with subject, it make those decisions. Or you could have a rules engine that implements a floor, and then you go up or down, as Chris says, based on the policy that comes out of these principles.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The line is now closed, so you're in the virtual line. You are, of course, in the line.
So does this mean you're going to give Kathy the last word?
I had assumed that that would happen anyway. So, Joe
Waldron from VeriSign. First, I would like to express my appreciation for all the hard work that went into this report. I truly do appreciate the complexity of essentially starting from a blank piece of paper and trying to address a large number of complex issues. I would like to drill down a little bit more into the registrant's point of view. I know we've talked a little bit about that. But my ultimate question, and I've got a couple preambles, but my ultimate question, just so you can start thinking about it, is have we looked at what the incremental cost is to a registrant? I know there was some mention of somebody that was offering to do validation for free. I say you get what you pay for. And I just look at the example of the Trademark Clearinghouse and what it costs to have a mark registered in the Trademark Clearinghouse where the validation, in many cases, is just validating against well-published national databases of trademarks. So if you start looking at that as a cost, I'm a little concerned when you're not just validating a trademark, you're validating all of the contact information, you're validating all of those mandatory and optional fields. So I do see that as a real cost, and I understand that you know that this is an ecosystem-wide kind of cost-sharing exercise, but that seems to be a cost that will be directly borne by registrants, and I think we need to take that into account. If you also look at the impact of an imbalance, Chris, you mentioned that .ca or ccTLDs won't be impacted by this. So are we creating an imbalance of significant incremental costs for gTLDs and putting gTLDs at a disadvantage as compared to ccTLDs? So I think that's another factor that we need to look at. So I just kind of pose that, and I think that it's important that we really look at this from the registrant's perspective in terms of complexity and also cost. And I'm just interested to know if you looked at that. I guess the other data point I wanted to also mention in the report, if I remember the IBM spreadsheet correctly, the RDS component of this, they estimated, was somewhere just a little bit north of $30 million over a five-year period. So that averages out to about 15 cents per name over that time period. So that's, a cost that will likely be added on to the fees that registrants pay. So when you start adding in the cost of running the infrastructure, the manpower at registrars, at registries, the RDS system, and I still believe this is intuitive, perhaps, or just looking at the track record of what happened with the Trademark Clearinghouse, a significant cost to do that validation. So I'm just interested if you've looked at what that potential impact is to the registrants.
So Stephanie and then Carlton.
I totally concur with your last remarks, and I would just like to throw in there, I don't think you mentioned audit logs. A lot of the privacy protections and abuse protections and everything depends on those audit logs, and speaking as ex-government, that's the kind of stuff that often just falls on the floor because nobody's reading them. So it's really important that we find the money for those audit logs for the gated data.
Thank you, Chris. This is Carlton. I wanted to address the issue of the validation costs. We did have a lot of discussions about that. And we heard from the UPU, which is Universal Postal Union, that they had they were the only ones who had very firm ideas about what validation would cost them. And they had so many different styles of postal systems to validate. So they are on the high-end uplier. And as it turned out, yes, there would be some additional cost, but in compared to what you got, we thought manageable. That's the first one. And one of the reasons we called for the risk analysis was because if you look at all of these issues in totality about the implementation with costs, and we had IBM come and do that, we felt that for the policy development purposes, given the principles that we have enunciated, it would be useful to have the risk analysis executed before or in conjunction with the policy development phase. So that's our way of saying, yes, we understand that there might be cost implications. We know that the cost implications are costs are going to come from certain areas of operation. We don't know how it's spread. But if before you do put the policy in place, do a risk analysis. Thanks.
One quick point to that, too, is, you know, I would contend some of those costs are already out there and being borne by different players in the, you know, roles in the internet system. I mean, Michele mentioned earlier that every time that he gets an inaccuracy report that he has to do something, that's a cost. Every time I report inaccurate WHOIS information to the compliance team at ICANN, somebody's working on that. You know, and every time I have to look that up and go, oh, this is obviously inaccurate, that's another, you know, there's a lot of waste and cost going on now. It may be redistributed, but I think I can figure that out, too. So.
And then, I'm
trying to understand, I mean, your point is that there's going to be cost that's going to be pushed out to maybe the registrars or the registrants, and one of the things that we really thought was really important, you know, in terms of building a model around the RDS was, okay, we want to make this, you know, have a cost recovery model, right? So within the system itself, we don't want costs being pushed down if we can actually create a system where it's making money enough so that it's recovering all those costs that it's actually incurring, right? So to a large extent, there's a lot of different things that we point out within the document itself, such as, you know, subscription fees for power users, blah, 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 you know, like premium access fees, stuff like that, that hopefully create certain revenues that then, you know, is...
Well, I would say that if the $30-plus million dollars for building out the RDS and operating that over a five-year period, I think the report recommends that be paid by ICANN.
I thought VeriSign was going to do it for free.
I think you read the wrong report. But that would be a significant portion of what ICANN is currently collecting for their per name registration fees today. So I think that again.
Thanks, Joe.
The costs are going to ultimately be paid by registrants, and we need to take that into account.
Thank you, Joe. Okay, Alex, you're next.
Hi, Alex Deakin again. A question on the validator. Can you go to the slide, Chris, on that shows kind of the flow chart that the validator do? That one, yes. So we've been talking about validation, and what caught my eye was this the validation piece there in step three. So this is a mandatory validation step, and is it based on kind of the existing registrar agreement 2013, or are you suggesting there's more validation that occurs there? We've talked about that.
Okay, I'll deal with this. Okay, basically, we didn't ignore what was in the 2013 or the 2009 or whatever. I mean, we went well beyond that. So in the report, there's comparisons between what we've proposed and what's in the current contract. I mean, ultimately, what we were asked to do was, you know, go back to the basics, go back to first principles, look at everything from zero. So if after deliberations, we'd ended up in a situation where we'd reduced things or increased them or whatever, then that would be okay, as long as we were aware of what the hell we were doing. The 2013 contract is unlike its, the previous contracts, in that there is a process which is clear and reasonably sane with respect to making amendments to the contract should that be required. Also, the who is specifications are a specification. They're not part of the core contract, so theoretically at least, and honestly I'm not ICANN staff, so I don't know how the hell that would work. In theory, if not in practice, it would be possible to make changes to certain elements of that without having to touch the main body of the contract.
Can I just ask one quick question? The validator, are all registrars, by definition validators also?
No. No, the what we discussed here was that validators could be third parties, could be companies that specialize in dealing with data and stuff, or they could be lawyers, they could be registrars, they could be any number of entities that met the requirements that... Let's just say, hypothetically, there is a certification process or a set of rules, a set of requirements, whatever the hell that works out to be. If an entity meets that and can provide that service, then they could fit into that. I mean, that, I think that's basically what we've said, and somebody else wants
to... Margie, did you want to say something first? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, cool.
Just Joe had been talking about Joe.
Joe, we're talking about you.
About the cost. If you go to page 65, it's actually not as high as he thought. It's 0.04 euros is the average. So it's a lot less.
Okay.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you. Okay. Joe, you talk to Margie. Margie, it's easier that way. And so, sorry. Hello.
Hi, it's me from JP Nick. I have a question related to the cost comparison of the synchronized model and federated model. Not in terms of the actual money, but first point related to the earlier comment made by somebody from Canada about the cost of leakage. And I understand that, like the earlier reply, that there may be less risk of having data leakage if you have the aggregated model to ensure that the security will be stronger. But are there specific measures taken or something in mind that ensures this? And the second point is, I think compared to the... The federated model, I think synchronized model adds additional layer of sharing information to a third party related to personal information. So it's not just within the GTLD registry, but you have to share all this personal information of your registrants to a third party. So that might add additional legal issues within certain economies, or if there are issues related to like data leakage, then what would be the point of responsibilities when these kind of things happen? So what are your observations in terms of this kind of cost with the two models?
So Faisal, do you want to take that? But we need to be brief.
Yeah, just on the synchronized model that you were talking about in terms of the security. I mean, we're talking about best practices, right? In terms of what we're going to be putting in there. You know, backups and disaster recovery plans, everything else that we, you know, balance loading and all the other security mechanisms that we could put into place for a system of this type. I mean, I don't think we've gone into detail as to what specifically we're going to put in there, but certainly...
Clearly you wouldn't have all the data in one place anyway, would you?
No, right, and it, right. Crazy.
And you were asking about did you say it was about the cost? No, there was the additional
layer of sharing personal data to a third party.
I'm not sure how that would. I don't think that is the case. If you, with the aggregated model, with the federated model.
Federated model. You don't have to share all the private information. You just refer to the information that's been queried. So, for example, you have like 10 sets of data.
Yeah. Got it. Thank you. Do you want to?
I guess it depends on how you define the sharing aspect of that, right? So, and this, I think, are you talking about, you know, the accommodation for a third party to be able, if they're using underneath the principles for the system, to be able to have that access the domain tools thing we were talking about earlier? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
No? No, then I'm not sure what the difference at the outer edge actually is.
I mean, I think it all depends on, this really does become a kind of a nomenclature type discussion, because if you look at synchronized and federated, you're still talking about data that's disaggregated across multiple servers. And then when you talk about sharing, it's really how you define sharing. I mean, it's like discussing in copyright, is a RAM copy a copy? And how many RAM copies were made to display one display? And so the question is, same thing with sharing, is did you share when you had to transport that data from the registry up to one place and display it? And is that any different than sharing when that registry sent it up to cache it somewhere? So we start to split hairs on what sharing means, I think. And I think we've been pretty educated on the fact that from a privacy and data protection standpoint, I don't think it makes a difference, that piece, because it all falls into a sharing type of bucket.
We need to move on, otherwise we're going to run out of time.
Okay, so
I apologize.
So I'll keep my question maybe outside of the
meeting. Well, you can come, or Wednesday morning, because we're coming back on Wednesday. Sure. But I am conscious that we need to finish with the people who have waited in line, and Wendy.
Hi.
And Matt, sorry.
I'm Fred Fellman, and I'm speaking as an individual registrant, because I've heard a lot of people representing me as a registrant, and I just wanted to actually point out a couple of things that I thought were kind of important. So I have domains managed by multiple registrars. Some of them are protected by privacy services, and some of them aren't. And recently, I got from a registrar a note from someone who was telling me that my domain was about to expire. And that was protected by a privacy and proxy service, which is an indication that the registrar who that was registered with was somehow breached, and that my private information was actually disclosed. And my guess is that they actually don't employ best practices, data practices, and disclose my data in some way in a breach. Also recently, from one that actually was protected by a privacy and proxy service, actually was not protected by a privacy and proxy service, I got a solicitation from a marketing organization which is misusing the data from the current system, proposing that I spend $75 a year to actually get SEO help on my site. It tells me that that this who is data is widely available and that the current system isn't working for me as a registrar. Also, I would say that that this data is widely available. Companies like some mentioned and some that are here actually sell this data in bulk for all kinds of purposes, and I've actually tried to negotiate some of that data to try and fill in some of the holes in our data. And I will tell you that right now the system does not work and that private data is disclosed widely, either accidentally or intentionally, for monetary gain and not currently. The system benefits that you're describing actually are clear to me as a registrant. And they actually harm my employer in some ways because they actually may restrict the way that that we do access data. But I still support this system because I think the current system harms registrars and causes problems. It provides gated access, which means that as someone enters the system, they must be identified. It requires disclosure. It requires audit. These are things that are not required right now by any of the systems in practice. And based on my personal experience and my personal data being exposed, I know that they're not using best practices. And there's rampant experience that we have as a domain naming system that data is regularly accidentally disclosed and that registrants are not informed and that other problems are happening. And you see that in the registry problems where names have been transferred and that sort of thing. And so I challenge the people behind me in the line to actually think as a registrant and think of the abuses that are occurring right now and actually think positively about the solution.
Thanks, Fred. Matt?
Hi, this is Matt Ashtiani for the record. We have a question from a remote participant. The question comes from John McCormick. John asks, is the system robust enough to deal with a bad actor using multiple business fronts to gain access?
Brief response, Fab? It's supposed to be, isn't it?
Yeah, it's supposed to be. It's envisioned to. I mean, we talked about modeling data analysis and picking up variances, et cetera. I mean, the example we always used was if someone logs in with a token and immediately starts doing 35,000 queries in 5 seconds, well, guess what? The system's going to be built to pick that up. If someone logs in, and this happens today, by the way, because we actually used the example of when I was at a law firm and we loved using Better Whois, I think now owned by Two Cows. And by noon, the firm was shut off because we were all doing searches to send cease and desist letters. It was five of us, and they were tracking our IP range. And so we would have to call them every day and go, hey, guys, it's us. Here's what we're doing. And they'd say, okay. And then the next day we'd get shut off again. That was 2001. So we're talking 2014. There has to be a system that's built that picks up those types of variances. And that's what we relied on.
Okay. Go for it.
Kathy Kleiman, non-commercial. First, McKaylee, not a conspiracy theory, just a lot to absorb.
I know. I was only winding you up, for God's sake.
You would never do that. Can we go back to the permissible purposes slide?
Sure.
And thanks. I know it's been a very long session, so thank you.
Yeah, but compared to the working group sessions, this is nothing.
Kathy, I am going to close this in 5 minutes. So, yeah, okay. Because we do have another session on Wednesday. So.
Okay. So, an observation and then a question. The observation is, aren't we working backwards here, where the purpose of the data is defined by the use of the data? And here, I'm thinking about my credit card data. I'm thinking about my healthcare data. These are collected for specific purposes, and if you defined it by everybody who wanted to use it in every way, the use would be a lot greater than it is now. Credit card data is used for credit purposes. Healthcare data is used for healthcare. This is used for much more than the technical purposes of domain name registration. This runs to content. So an observation on that. So quick question, and maybe we'll continue it on Wednesday, but don't two principles seriously undermine the rest of the framework that you're putting together? First principle is individual internet use. The idea that, as I understand it, that an individual can go in and try to identify a company that they're working with, which may be legit, or an organization that's using a domain name. And maybe they don't like the views of that organization. They don't like what's being said. That ability to come in and find the address and the phone number, and that personal or sensitive data of any organization that you don't agree with, doesn't that undermine free speech, freedom of expression, individual internet use undermining, informed consent.
Yeah, but to informed consent. I wasn't trying to stop you. I was just trying to say, can somebody address the individual internet use bubble?
I'm trying to actually make sense of what you all said as you pushed two or three things in together.
That it means that an individual can be accredited
to
go into the...
Can't.
So what is individual internet use then?
That's basically it's very close to the DNS transparency use, is being able to get basic information about a domain name. So in that case, we'd actually... Yeah, it's the business, and finding the business contact, finding just basic information about when the domain was registered, all that kind of stuff. It's the public data.
So
in
the report, we have explanations of what each one of these bubbles is meant to mean. And again, we can become...
They don't all get access behind the gate.
Exactly.
Necessarily.
They all get access behind the gate. But I think the key here is that we can fixate on the actual words, or actually see what it's. I can't remember what it says, which is why I'm asking.
It says you get the data behind the gate.
No, but does it say what it's for? And does it say
says
what
address?
Does it say what individual internet use?
Right. So, and this would, the criteria would have to be. This is back to implementation, in my opinion. A lot of definitions need to be put into this, but. In some ways we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't here. So,
that's for sure.
Yeah. So, if the way Susan Kawaguchi would define that, if I went to a website and they were offering a service and were willing to take my credit card, they had a shopping cart on it, I don't really have a right to know who I'm doing business with. So, therefore, there would be some information, maybe just the registrant name or, whatever, that I would know they are declaring they are them, put it that way.
Yeah, so I think we're
so,
Lisa, do you want to?
If you could put up slide 40.
Slide 40. There are 40 slides?
I am.
I'll just... Okay, here we go. Kathy? There you go. Individual internet use, query scope, legal person, contact needed, business, registrant data needed, so that's what it's for.
Can I point out that page 27 seems to contradict that by talking about the legal postal address that appears to be public in some lists and not in other lists? So again, an inconsistency that if developed could wind up exposing organizations for their expression and not for their credit card acceptance.
Okay, Jean-Francois.
So first of all, very, very sincere thank you for the 3 hours and 15 minutes that we spent together, including 2 hours of full pure Q&A. Just also keep in mind that in case you still have further questions, I'm sure you will have when you slip over, because I think it has been very dense. We will have a session at on Wednesday from 8 to 10 in the morning. Okay, and once again, there will be 2 hours that we'll be very happy to have with everybody. Hopefully also we do hope that you find through this session quite interesting and quite fruitful, and you find the answer of the question that you were asking. Because from what I have detected, basically, it was very good questions, very legitimate questions, but I found out that probably most of the people get what they were asking for. Sorry for the acceleration of our work that we have done between Singapore and now in terms of the density of our findings and the maturity of our report. So from the preliminary report and the final report now, I think it's a huge, huge acceleration of the intensity of work that we have done here, and such, as you pointed out, Kathy, I think it's very legitimate that between what you've seen before and what you are now exposed, it's a massive amount of thing that needs to be digested, and once again, difficult to pick only one or two topics like that, has to be considered as a one body to get to grasp the full intent of those recommendations. So I think this is very, very important. As we mentioned a few times, we will be very happy to post some addendum to the report for clarification in case things have not been put in the right wording. So this is going to be orchestrated and done for all clarification which is needed from this final report. But the bottom line lies into this room as the final question. The final question is for you to decide if the RDS that we have proposed is in fact better solution and better proposal than what is currently is the WHOIS system. And we do hope that you are fully equipped now, after many digestion of this report, at least, to answer this question. With that, thank you very much for everyone, and hope to see some of you on Wednesday.